All right. Good morning, everyone. Nick Coyle here from AusChamp. To my right, I've got Lachlan Cruz, and to my left, Dan Boyer. Thank you. Well, it's morning, everyone, here in China, and afternoon in Australia and wherever else you're tuning in from. A couple of housekeeping things. If you have any technical problems, don't panic. This will be up on the website later. So if you have any technical problems, you know, you've unfortunately a Vodafone subscriber in Australia or something, I do have Vodafone, it's terrible. And you have a problem, don't worry, you can get it on the website later. If you have any major technical problems, so you can see me but can't hear me and not sure, check your browser first. Second thing I'd suggest you do is dial in through a different device if that's your problem. And last port of call, you can ping andy.foo@austrade.gov.au and he can see if he can help you. It is Chatham House rules today, so please, if any of our wonderful journalist friends are on the line or anyone else, you know, please can we keep what's discussed in this room and the virtual room in here. If you do have questions or queries that you want an official response on, always happy to, you know, to receive your inquiry and we'll assist where we can. And finally, if you've got any feedback, any suggestions for the future on webinars or information or things you'd like us to do at AusChamp or AusTrade or any of us here, feel free to reach out to me directly. My email address is nick.coyle@auschamp.org, and you can get me on 1551 02 888 24. So any feedback, if you don't like my shirt, whatever, that's fine. I had somebody commented on my shirt last week, so I had to throw that out there.
I'm sure it was born.
It could have been. So any feedback, or if you're in isolation in Australia and you just want to have a chat, give me a call, give me some feedback. Without further ado, I'll hand over to Lachlan, who's going to kick things off. Then Dan will come in, and then myself at the end. If you've got questions, please, you can flick them to me directly if you've got my WeChat or email, or to Christian Ricardo, and that's KRISTIAN.RICARDO@auschamp.org. Over to you, Mr. Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle, and good morning, China, and others who are listening in. It's great to have the opportunity to speak to you all this morning. I'm just going to give you a brief update, starting with the embassy and some of our priorities here. I'll mention a couple of things about the AusChamp survey, which was done a little while ago, and I know there's another one on the way. Talk about the Chinese economy for a while. And then mention the US-China Phase 1 trade deal and some support that Australia has for exporters to conclude. So without further ado, just to let you know where we are in terms of the embassy staffing levels as a whole, we're still down well below half capacity, about 40% at the moment. My economic team that on the DFAT side is three, including myself and Diana, who's with us today. Down from eight normally, but many other people are working as they can from Australia on things. Families were withdrawn in early February, around the time Australia went to do not travel for China, but those of us left are focused on our regular jobs, so we're maintaining the political relationship, supporting two-way trade and investment, and providing consular support. One of the main things we've been doing over the last several weeks, both DFAT, AusTrade, and people from Customs and the Industry Department back home, is to facilitate the export of masks, gloves, so-called PPE, and medical devices back to Australia. China's new regulations for the export of medical equipment have imposed some conditions on these exports. It's not a ban, and we're working with a number of companies to understand and comply with the new rules by liaising with the Ministry of Commerce and other agencies as we need to do that. If there's anything we can do to assist Australian companies, please get in touch through the Chamber after this event. There are limits to what we can achieve, but it's in everyone's interest to help where we can. Just a couple of points before I go to the economy on the AusChamp survey. I've seen some sort of preliminary data from the one that was done back in February. It's a really useful exercise to have this sort of information. Part of our job as government representatives in China is to advocate for Australian business interests here, and the more information we have about your situation, the easier it is to do that. I gather there's a shorter version of the survey on the way. Almost, you know, every company that was asked about the outlook back in February expressed negative sentiment. That's only natural. The only sectors to do well typically out of this sort of event are health and e-commerce, which Daniel will come back to in a minute. The magnitude of the expected decrease in revenue in the report at that time, so 39% of Australian businesses said they expected a fall of revenue over 20%, with a skew to smaller businesses, lines up more or less with the recent experience of Chinese business. So some research done recently by the Tsinghua School of Finance suggests that revenues for medium and small companies dropped 69.5% in the first quarter of 2020, an enormous fall. And that kind of segues us nicely into the Chinese economy. Now, when I talk about the economy, these are my own views as someone who's observing the business environment and trying to understand it. It's not a formal Australian government position. But with that said, the story more or less for China now is about how quickly things can get back to normal. Consultants and analysts who track these things estimate the Chinese economy is running at about 80 to 85% of capacity at the moment. GDP results for the first quarter are out today. They should have been released probably in the last 10 minutes or so. I haven't seen them, but markets are expecting a fall in the range of sort of 6 to 15% year on year in the first quarter. So we'll see how that plays out. It'll be interesting to just to partly to test the Chinese system's willingness to put out a set of bad numbers. Trade remains subdued in US dollar terms. China's exports fell 6.6% in March from a year ago after a 17.2% decline in January-February. Imports were also down 9.9% year-on-year after falling 4% in Jan-Feb. So continued contraction of Chinese trade, but not quite at the magnitude we saw in the first 2 months of the year. It's taking quite a long time to get back to normal. The PMI, Purchasing Manufacturers Index numbers for February and March, 35.7 and 52 respectively, illustrate that. So a huge fall in February, followed by a very, very modest recovery in March. Although China is clearly through the worst of the viral outbreak, the economy is operating well below capacity. If you put all of that together, it seems clear enough that the shape of the recovery will not be a quick V-shaped one as it was after the SARS epidemic in 2003. And just as China's manufacturing hubs are coming back online, export orders from the key trading partners around the world are sliding as the virus starts to bite overseas. What we've seen is that bigger firms and those connected to critical supply chains, especially in manufacturing and tech, are doing better and getting more help from provincial governments, as are SOEs, which tend to be on the larger end of scale anyway. Small and medium-sized firms are struggling, as I noted in those income figures a minute ago. According to the Tianyanta website, a commercial database that compiles public records, about 460,000 firms went out of business in the first quarter of the year, almost double the normal number of 250,000. Most of those will be in small businesses, in entertainment, hospitality or tourism, and some will have been customers for Australian exports or services delivered by Australian firms here. So although things are stabilising, we can expect subdued demand and probably lower prices for some key exports, which Daniel will get back to in more detail. On the question of Chinese stimulus, all indications are that we're not in for a repeat of the 2009 large-scale stimulus program China rolled out after the global financial crisis. At least we are not there yet. Chinese provinces have announced plans for infrastructure spending worth about 3.5% of GDP in 2020, which will boost demand, but it isn't a major deviation from what was planned already. A lot of that infrastructure will be in 5G communications, mobile phone towers and advanced connectivity. So the implications in terms of how quickly it will be rolled out and what it means for Australian resources exports are a bit different to conventional roads and bridges sort of infrastructure. I've also noted that a number of provincial and city level governments are putting out consumption vouchers, sometimes with a limited time window. So the government is obviously very keen to make sure that as much consumption as possible that would have happened in February is deferred into March, April, rather than abandoned completely. On the monetary side, the People's Bank of China has provided a considerable amount of liquidity into the financial system, most recently through a 20 basis point cut to the medium-term lending facility. PBOC has signalled that more support could be on the way. We'll know more after the Lianghui, which now looks likely for early May, although we don't have dates. That would normally be when we find out about the growth target for the year and broad guidance on infrastructure plans and the size of the fiscal deficit. On the US-China Phase 1 trade deal, Australia welcomed the Phase 1 deal when it was announced in January and came into effect in mid-February. That's because the deal delivered a pause in the so-called trade war and brought a bit of stability to the US-China trade relationship. My main message for Australian companies is that the deal is still out there. Throughout the pandemic period, when the Chinese system has been mostly preoccupied with managing the outbreak, Chinese regulators continue to implement many parts of the deal to do with agricultural commodity standards and timelines for accreditation and listing of US export facilities. The parts of the deal that set out purchase commitments, so China agreed to buy another $200 billion US dollars worth of exports over the 2017 baseline between this year and next year. It's a bit too early to say how that's going to play out, but neither side has backed away from the deal at this point. We expect the impact on Australia will be relatively limited. Many important US exports like pork, chicken and soybeans, Australia either doesn't produce in significant quantities or we don't have technical market access for China. For other goods, the 2015 China-Australia Free Trade Agreement, or CHAFTA, still means that Australia has a significant advantage in terms of competitiveness, and we've established pretty good supply relationships in many of those areas, which will help. So the message is that it will, all other things being equal, make the US a bit more competitive in some areas. Both the US and China have said the deal will be implemented in a way that is WTO consistent and will not disadvantage China's other major trading partners. We look forward to those commitments being fulfilled. Just finally, on what the Australian government is doing to help export affected sectors, Daniel will talk about the International Air Freight Assistance Mechanism, but I'm going to mention briefly the Export Capital Facility, which Minister Birmingham announced on the 15th of April. It's costed at $500 million Australian dollars. The Export Capital Facility will be managed by Export Finance Australia, our export credit agency, which until recently was known as EFIC. Exporters will be able to access loans and other forms of financial assistance from $250,000 up to $50 million under the facility if they're unable to get commercial finance. Exporters can use the facility if they've been trading for at least 2 years, have had profitable operations in either of the two financial years prior to the impact of COVID-19, can't secure finance from the private market, and have a turnover of at least $250,000. Those loans can be used for working capital support, to make capital investments, to expand internationally, or to explore e-commerce opportunities. If you're interested in the facility, I think the best port of call is to contact Export Finance Australia directly through their website, but you can also get in touch with us through the Chamber and we can connect you. I will leave it there and hand over to Daniel Boyer from Austrade, but happy to take questions in due course. Thanks.
Thanks, Lachlan. Last time I briefed AusCham, I talked about, and ACBC as well, I talked about some broader trends we're seeing in the economy here and what they might mean for Australian business going forward. Given that Lachlan's already covered a fair bit of that this time, I want to quickly touch on the latest around ports, freight, logistics, and as Lachlan says, the Australian government's recent establishment of the International Freight Assistance Mechanism. So I want to talk a little bit about a couple of consumer trends we're seeing and what that might mean for exporters. And then I want to dig into some of the sectors, which I didn't have time to do last time because the impact of COVID-19 has been quite differential depending upon which sector you're involved in. First, though, just to reassure everyone that Austrade is still here in China. Our local staff are back at pretty much full strength, although in Hong Kong, we're currently working from home because of the spike in imported cases there. Being in Shanghai, Tim in Chengdu, Dane in Guangzhou and myself in Beijing are all on deck. The rest of my team are back in Australia, largely working from home, something Austrade is geared up more than most agencies to do. We will look to do some staff changeover in the coming month or two, although I'll be here until at least July, subject to families returning to post. And whether divorce proceedings are filed against me. The most important message for you to take out of that is that we're here, we're working, and you can get in contact with us at any stage. So how are ports and broader logistics tracking in China at the moment? Ports are pretty much back to normal operations now after a difficult period through February and early March. when mandatory quarantine and movement restrictions had a significant impact on port workers, but also on export cargo truck drivers. We are hearing some recent reports that the new quarantining measures for ships' crews is having an impact on the speed of unloading, but throughput is close to last year's levels. Latest reports suggest that all major ports in China are achieving 90% or more of the average throughput at the same time last year in March. The fact that volumes are slightly lower than last year is possibly an indicator of softer demand as much as it is of any residual supply-side issues. With that said, we're yet to see the full impact on port logistics globally as COVID-19 spreads around the world, and as with all things global logistics, that'll take a while to wash through the system. Finally, on ports, almost half of the river ports in Hubei are now operating, including Wuhan, and iron ore throughput at major ports was back to more than 97% of last year's volume. On air freight, last week the Civil Aviation Authority in China reported that from the 6th to the 12th of April, a total of nearly 4,500 cargo flights filed flight schedules. That is a more than 300% increase on pre-COVID-19 average of just over 1,000 weekly flights. However, the challenge here is of course, cost. Recent reports we've seen suggest that per kilo prices are varying anywhere between 2 and 5 times as much as normal, and sometimes considerably higher than that. Australia, of course, has a much higher reliance on passenger aircraft freight for most of its fresh produce, especially seafood, fresh dairy, some horticulture, and a small amount of chilled meat. 90% of our air freight with China is carried in the bellies of passenger planes, so the 98% reduction in passenger flights between Australia and China has hit these agricultural subsectors disproportionately. That's the principal reason why the Australian government has stood up the International Freight Assistance Mechanism, which will see the government allocate $110 million to assist Australia's agricultural and seafood export sectors to access key global markets. With return flights bringing back some of those precious medical supplies that Lachlan referred to earlier, medicines, PPE and equipment that are important to Australia's ongoing health response to COVID-19. Austrade is leading a whole of government task force to operationalise this initiative. It's overseen by Michael Byrne, who's the ex-Toll CEO, amongst many other esteemed positions within the logistics space. Key export focus sectors are seafood, dairy, red meat and horticulture. Initially, there'll be 4 departure hubs in Australia, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane and Perth, and flights will travel to a number of end destinations, including mainland China and Hong Kong. We're expecting a further announcement about this today. If it hasn't already come out, it will do shortly, around the outcome of the tender processes for airlines and freight forwarders. So keep an eye on our website for that. While we're on the subject of new programs, the government's also announced further support for exporters in the shape of an additional $50 million or so for the Export Market Development Grant Scheme this year, which will bring the total amount of funding available to more than $200 million, the highest it's been in more than 20 years. For those familiar with EMDG, what this means in practice is that for applications lodged this year for 2018-19 tax year, the payout factor for the second tranche will be 100% rather than the 20 to 30% it has been in previous years. You can find out more information about Commonwealth and state government support programs for exporters on our COVID-19 webpage, along with a treasure trove of other useful information. Nick, you can, if you can, put a link up on the AusCham web page if it's not there already after this this webinar. Moving to consumer behaviour, last time I talked about the shifting demographics of Chinese e-commerce consumers during COVID-19 and how this is likely, or a lot of this is likely to last beyond the pandemic and also spread outside China to being a more global phenomenon. This time I wanted to touch quickly on the potential growth in Chinese consumer nationalism and how this will be an important consideration for Australian firms as they navigate online. So social media and e-commerce in China will obviously be crucial tools for Australia's recovery in a post-COVID China market, due in part to the increased shift of Chinese consumers online, but also because of the potential for amplification of branding and distribution within these channels. However, these tools need to be handled quite carefully, particularly as Chinese consumers show some signs of increasing nationalism. China Skinny in Shanghai had an excellent case study last week on consumer behaviour related to Chinese coffee startup Luckin Coffee. Despite its stock plummeting by 80% in the wake of fraudulent over-reporting of earnings, Luckin set customer acquisition records with 300,000 people downloading the app in one day immediately following reporting of the fraud. The previous highest day was less than 100,000. The suggestion here is that support for the homegrown little guy in its battle against the American coffee giant Starbucks is at least partially behind this this consumer reaction. This is a trend we've seen before. Research firm Canalys reported that Huawei saw its smartphone sales in China jump to a 38.5% share of the market in 2019 compared to 27% a year earlier. In part due to a boost in nationalist sentiment after the company came under increasing pressure from the US and other Western countries. The key message here is that we're in a highly charged geopolitical environment at the moment, and that the volatility of consumer sentiment, not just in China but all over the world, can influence a foreign brand's prospects vis-a-vis its national competitors. So what are we seeing across some of our key export sectors? Over the last month or so, a number of countries have announced temporary export restrictions or bans on some agricultural commodities, including rice from Vietnam and Cambodia, and buckwheat rice and oat flakes from Russia. These export restrictions and the increased domestic demand and supply interruptions in Europe and North America do present opportunities for Australian companies in a range of areas. Along a similar vein, we've been receiving a significantly increased number of queries from importers in Hong Kong, where 95% of the city's F&B is imported. This presents an immediate short-term opportunity for Australian suppliers to meet supply gaps in Hong Kong, but also in other parts of the mainland as well. Research by Meat and Livestock Australia on the impact of COVID-19 on Chinese consumers points to sustained opportunities for high-value Australian red meat exports in China. Before COVID-19, the top three considerations of consumers buying beef was safety, freshness and quality, whereas during COVID-19 it was safety, boosting immunity and quality. Australia's reputation for clean and healthy food is an asset in the post-COVID market. Demand is slowly returning for premium seafood, but it remains patchy and prices are still well below pre-COVID-19 levels. According to the Guangzhou Catering Association, seafood restaurants, especially large-scale ones, are experiencing particularly hard times. As per previous reports, estimates across the broader hospitality suggest that up to 25% of restaurants are now closed permanently across China. Aside from iron ore, which I flagged earlier, was close to the same throughput in Chinese ports in March as last year. In resources, LNG continues to be relatively unscathed, although the spot price is low. It's worth noting that on 3rd April, NDRC approved a 5 MPTA LNG terminal proposal by Beijing Gas Group. A terminal at South Port Industry Zone in Tianjin will feed Tianjin, Beijing and Hebei provinces. This is a 20.1 million RMB investment with phase one to be completed by 2022. In health, with challenges in recruitment and site access in mainland China, the US and EU, Australian contract research organisations are reporting increased interest from Chinese biotechs in conducting clinical trials in Australia, as well as resurgent demand in the Hong Kong and Taiwan markets for locally conducted trials. This is reflective of broader interest we're seeing across the various health subsectors, particularly around research collaboration with an unsurprising focus on epidemiology, biotechnology and pharmaceuticals as well. And in technology too, finally, the increase in digital gaming and video sharing platforms has been pronounced and presents some substantial opportunities for Australian tech companies. Earlier next month, we'll be running our first virtual landing pad boot camp connecting a group of Australian games developers with relevant Chinese companies, first of many such initiatives, we suspect. So what does all this mean in the medium to long term? Like Lachlan, I'll preface this by saying that this is my opinion as opposed to any particular government position. Last time I talked about the fact that it's still very difficult to determine where the global economy, let alone the Chinese economy, is going to end up after all of this is over. Where the international trading order ends up at the end of COVID-19 remains to be seen too, of course. Although my personal view is that trade will be critical to any nation's ability to bounce back from higher budgetary deficits and from limited monetary policy effectiveness. And certainly there are more green shoots coming out of the Australia-China trading story now than there were a month ago, especially in some parts of F&B, in resources and energy, and certainly in health and technology. I can see all of those sectors rebounding, although with the certain hit to Chinese incomes, it will likely not be a V-shaped curve, more slow growth over months and potentially years, at least in some industries. And the differential effects on certain sectors here in China, property, travel, hospitality, and to a lesser extent retail, will take a while to wash through. It's highly likely that we'll lose local players in these sectors, especially SMEs. Finally, and I hate to sound like a broken record, but just to reiterate a key theme of the trends we've been seeing for the last 2 months, it's absolutely critical for Australian companies selling stuff in China to have a sound e-commerce and social media marketing strategy. That will only become more important after COVID. And I'll leave it at that. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, Dan. Terrific. Look, Lachlan mentioned at the beginning about the GDP numbers, so I thought may as well. I had a quick look at those while people were talking, so I thought I'll quickly actually mention those because they might give us some context for some questions as well. Now, please, just a reminder, if you've got any questions for Lachlan or Dan, please fire them in. So the data that Lachlan referred to was released about 15 minutes ago, about half an hour ago now. So GDP in China was down 6.8% in the first quarter, which was pretty much in line with what a lot of analysts believed. Around that sort of 6.5 was, I saw a survey a while ago that economists predicted. So not hugely surprising. Retail was down 19%, industrial production down 8.4%. And then I just managed to get a quick look at behind some of those numbers, which I think makes some interesting observations. So in industrial production, even though it was down 8.4% for the quarter, it was 13.5% in February and then down only 1.1% in March. So hopefully that indicates a good trend going forward into April and the June quarter, that we might get back to some positivity in industrial production. On the retail numbers, January, February was down 20% and March down 15.8. So again, it looks like there's some recovery in March, but obviously not as, shall we say, significant a recovery as what we've seen in industrial production. And the third little number that I could manage to get across was fixed investment. So fixed investment, not surprisingly, down quite significantly, 16.1% for the quarter, but January, February down just over 20%. So again, it looks like there was some recovery in March, which is, I guess, not all that surprising. So that's a quick sort of tail of the tape of the numbers that have just come out this morning. And I guess we'll have a chance to digest them and see what they mean over the coming days and weeks. Now, as Lachlan mentioned, we did a survey about 6 weeks ago. I thought I'd do a really quick recap. So, Andy, if you've got that slide ready, that would be magnificent. All right, so really quickly, as Lachlan mentioned, we did a reasonably comprehensive survey about 6 weeks ago. Now, what we're looking to do, and we've got a summary up on our website, this is just a quick summary of some of the key outcomes from it. So we had a bit over 100 respondents across China. We also had quite a few in Australia as well, I should note. And this was done really when things were starting to get real, so to speak, over here. And Andy, if we could pop through to the next slide, that would be terrific. As Lachlan mentioned, a very significant prediction was made that there'd be a significant negative on the business. And as Lachlan mentioned, and I think some of the data that we've just seen here in China has borne out that that was pretty accurate. And I think the interesting one on the next slide is, you know, is looking through what the impact might be for the rest of the year. So looking at expected revenue impact for the whole of year 2020. And I think that's going to be an interesting one for us to trace and have a look at. Now, as Lachlan mentioned, we are going to do some more surveys. We're going to do a few industry-specific surveys, and then we might come back to some of these broader questions and get an update and get that out to people very, very quickly. So anybody who's on the call, expect a survey from us over the next week or so. We're going to do them much shorter, 4, 5, 6 questions tops, and then we're going to look at doing some industry-specific surveys. I think one of the key things at the moment from, and it's probably very hard for all of us trying to keep a track of what's going on, is how quickly things change. So that's what we're looking to do. So please keep an eye on communications coming from us at the Chamber. And if you're out there in industry and you're also got, if you're also interested in getting some data on what business is looking at and what business is doing, by all means, you know, send through a request to us and we'll see if we can find out for you. But what we're seeing on the ground here in China now, and this is, you know, very much anecdotally, but it matches with some of the data we've just seen. So things are, so for people back in Australia, things are increasingly getting back to normal here. There's the pleasant, traffic jams that are starting to reappear here in Beijing and across the rest of the country. What else are we seeing? Schools are starting to go back, not in Beijing as yet, but the government has announced a number of schools, local schools will be going back, quite a number are back already and then throughout the month. And so by the end of April, most schools in China will be back. Beijing, of course, being very special, I haven't announced as to when. International schools, we don't have any idea on yet. The other thing that has cropped up and that we're actively looking at, because some people have asked me questions about this, is also on the issue of people who have got work permits trying to come back into China, and we're actively looking at that as well. So that's a bit of a brief update on us, what we're doing. Interesting, those numbers that we've just seen, and I might actually kick off with a question to Dan and Lachlan. You guys have just seen those numbers come through at the same time as I have. Got any initial thoughts?
Very, very initial thoughts, Nick. 6.8%, I presume that's a year-on-year rather than a quarter-on-quarter figure. Yeah. It is roughly in line with the consensus. I mean, there were some forecasts that went into the teens, but a lot of them were around the sort of 6 to 8% mark. So it's not a great number. I think it's encouraging that NBS continues to put out these pretty bad figures, actually. There's the perennial question about Chinese statistics, particularly the GDP number and whether they're reliable. We were encouraged when the PMI, which is also an NBS number, was put out and had a catastrophic reading of 35.7 for February. So it's, again, this is a bad number. What I found interesting in looking into the other data that's just come out is the unemployment rate apparently has declined to 5.9 from 6.2. Now, that obviously is only a partial reading of unemployment, that it doesn't capture migrant workers in the informal sector, but that's still in some ways a bit surprising given the kind of contraction, although I know that the time periods are not exactly the same. We'll be digging into the rest of the data over the course of the day and updating Canberra on where we stand.
So, just as you were talking, somebody messaged me. Apparently Beijing schools were announced for 27th of April, so there you go, including international schools.
I think that's only for some grades.
Right. Yeah,
year 9 and
year
12.
Nine and year,
and then 11th of May, I think, for the remainder.
Right.
I think is the suggestion. But, yeah.
Excellent. Initial thoughts, Dan? Got any anything to add?
No, Lachlan's said it all. He's the macro economist amongst us, so I'll leave it to his assessment. I was quite surprised by that unemployment figure, though, and I think that was a disastrous figure in February, without doubt. It was the one that I was most focused on, I must say. So the fact that it's come down, I'm surprised. It doesn't track things like small business owners either, as well as migrant workers, and that's one of the challenges too. So I think if you take that basically adds a few grains of salt to it, and you take it in conjunction with the stat that Lachlan referred to before of 460,000 businesses going out of work in the first couple of months, or February, was it February, March, first quarter, compared to the 250,000 normally, then that's quite sobering still, I think. Mm.
No doubt. Now, I've got a question here from James. Wanted to check on foreign direct investment and whether the central government will look to restrict this, as it would potentially prefer its money to be spent domestically. So do we think that capital accounts are going to get restricted further?
So I presume that the question is talking about outbound rather than inbound, because that last element. We haven't seen any signs of that yet. Certainly the narrative from the central government's point of view has all been about continued reform and opening, and there have been a few encouraging signs in the Chinese investment environment recently to do with trust companies and securities and things, some connected to the US phase one trade deal and others autonomous. But on the outbound side, I mean, the trend, I think, for several years has been a general decline in the scale of Chinese outbound investment. But that's more to do with sort of capital controls and things like that. It's difficult to know in some ways whether that trend is going to continue. But there's been no indication, no signals from the government that they want to prevent outbound investment more than the constraints that are already there.
Mm. I mean, the only rider that you'd tack on that is that we'll find out when it becomes public. So. It's been much in the Chinese system. I think it's worth pointing out, I think you sort of touched on this, Lachlan, that the scale of Chinese government stimulus, including investment, is small comparatively for the size of population and the size of the economy compared to the EU countries and the US, and potentially even Australia if you take it on basis of per capita. So that would indicate that they're not necessarily looking at significantly diverting money from international into domestic, at least as an early indication. But we'll be the last to know.
All right. I've got a question here about you're touching on logistics. So a question from June. CAAC announced last week a banning of airlines, and this includes cargo, from price leaders. So must be putting a price ceiling on beyond regular policies. Mm. Have you heard much about that and whether it's been effective?
No, actually I hadn't. Deanna, had you heard anything about that?
I think it's in response to the increasing prices of charter flights, which we have heard have sort of soared to as high as $4 million US dollars per flight, their GAC, sorry, CAAC, the Civil Aviation Administration of China, previously announced quite significant subsidies for Chinese and foreign airlines, including those that are involved in charter flights, particularly in relation to the transport of PPE and medical supplies. Mm. So the Chinese government will be refunding a portion of the costs for those flights, and so the cap on the prices for the charter flights is in everybody's interest.
Right.
Those who are chartering the freight, but also the Chinese government that's providing the subsidies to support those flights.
And I think I haven't seen the measure, but it's very plausible, because those fare increases will be hitting Chinese citizens overseas who are trying to get back. The government's been very clear that although passenger flights are down 98%. The government's been very supportive of the growth in the freight industry to compensate. So you put that together with the impact on Chinese citizens attempting to return home, and it's a pretty reasonable outcome.
Mm. Mm. I should make note, Deanna Easton, the Councillor Economic at the Embassy as well. I forgot to mention that you were here at the beginning. Well, thanks for that. I also have, well, actually, related question. How's freight going? You mentioned freight. How are prices going from Australia? Because that's another big issue that I've heard, certainly out of China.
Yes. And so that's one of the reasons why the government announced the international freight assistance mechanism for that very reason. But the last, I mean, we've seen
how's that working.
It's not working yet. Although we've seen quite a few flights that have sort of come under the early auspices of the scheme that Michael Byrne and others have been actually involved in terms of getting large amounts of lamb into the Middle East, for example, and delivery of seafood into Taiwan too. I think I said in my presentation 2 to 5 times as much was what we were hearing, and sometimes significantly more, outrageously.
10 to 15.
Outrageously more. And so you can see that, I mean, the airline industry is under a lot of pressure at the moment, and if they're looking at any way that they can try and minimise their losses, they'll do it. And that's why the government felt as though they needed to step in and provide some support to ensure that these freight prices were not prohibitively expensive and could actually get produce to market. There's clearly demand there. That's the other thing. I mean, seafood notwithstanding, there's some challenges, but the demand in seafood is sort of a bit patchy at the moment. It has gone, price of lobster, for example, has gone up, but nowhere near pre-COVID 19 levels. But the demand for other products in terms of prices has remained reasonably consistent here, and it's actually going up in places like Hong Kong, where they're getting a bit concerned about the, you know, 95% imported food economy as it is, getting a bit concerned about the availability as other countries sort of control the export of their agricultural products.
Okay, I've got another question for you too, Dan, from Charlene. You mentioned that having e-commerce and social media strategy in China is essential for Australian exporters, and couldn't agree with you more. Could you please elaborate a bit more as to why and what and how Australian exporters should be doing more in this area?
I think in part it's because... why? Let's start with why. Understanding the intrinsic link between e-commerce platforms and social media marketing here is not something that comes easily for Western businesses, I think. And understanding how to connect with Chinese consumers and the types of ways in which you can do that. Building partnerships with good e-commerce platforms and with businesses that have experience in that area with reliable and reputable people. I think building partnerships with good social media marketing firms is kind of critical here. Depending on what business you're in, if you're in the LNG business, of course, there's not much value. So I should be clear that really I'm focused more on things like food, beverage, consumer, that type of stuff, not the bulk commodities or anything along those sorts of lines. I think the key is that this is the space where Chinese consumers get most of their information in a way that it's not in other parts of the world. And so if you don't have a strategy that picks up or understands the way that Chinese consumers behave, then you're going to fall foul of what is a ruthless and challenging marketplace to get your stuff out. So that'll probably do, I think, Nick, as an answer.
Yep, no problems. Now, I've got a question from PM here. She's touched on China announcing big plans for developing major infra projects. She's talked about 5G and EV, because I assume electric vehicles,
yep,
and about opportunities for Australian business. Now, I'm thinking 5G for obvious reasons, no, given that's on the negative list for foreign investment. But of the sort of policies that the government's announced in terms of investment into infra, do you see any opportunities for Australian business there?
Look, there are a couple of different elements to this. We probably won't know the full infrastructure story until the Liang Wei has happened. There have been a lot of things announced at the provincial government level, but many of those are sort of plans or aspirational rather than things that are actually funded and are definitely going to happen. But with that said, I think there are opportunities with any infrastructure project. There's a couple of dimensions to that. I guess one is the supply of raw materials that will go into some of those, even though they're more into connectivity, 5G, and those things than, you know, building another road. You'll still see some demand for metals, demand for energy will increase. So I think there'll be an element of that which will potentially benefit Australian companies. And the other thing, I guess, is, you know, we're never going to be the lead contractor on these projects, but there will be opportunities around the edges for legal services, financial services, consulting, architecture, design, environmental remediation, things like that. So there is potential for Australian companies to pick up, you know, potentially bits of those, and some Australian companies like Macquarie are already quite involved in the infrastructure sector in China already.
Yeah, that's right. I would add that there are opportunities for Australian tech companies in China already. I mean, if you look at one of the areas that has actually grown over the last 3 months, it's one of the few areas that's grown globally. It's been digital technology, digital games, video sharing platforms, etc. There is Australian capability in these areas, and we don't talk about it enough, I don't think, but there is Australian capability in these areas in things like AI, the Internet of Things, etc. There is the potential for Australian firms to engage with Chinese companies on those things. So of course, they have to be careful about anything that has, not just in China, but anywhere around the world, with dual use potential for certain technologies. But there are opportunities, and certainly we're seeing a steady flow of technology companies coming through our landing pad program into China.
Okay, great. Actually, talking about tech, we've got UTCP and Michael High simulcasting this webinar today. So thanks to the guys down in Shenzhen. They're a tech hub down in Shenzhen. What was the other question? Coming from Patricia, this is back onto you, Dan, you're in the hot seat again. Would you mind explaining how the international freight scheme works, preconditions, criteria, processes?
I wish I could. However, the answers will all come out today, I am assured. So there'll be a link on our website straight afterwards. The principle is, though, that freight, as we've said, is too expensive for many exporters and makes it prohibitively expensive for them to continue to derive income from exports. So the idea is that the government won't be taking all of that load, but it will make it at least reasonably cheaper. So what they've done is gone out to tender for airlines, for freight forwarders, and an expression of interest for exporters. And they're now, what will be announced at the end of today, as I understand it, are the airlines and the freight forwarders that are involved in that process, another expression of interest for more exporters. But from what I hear, the numbers are looking pretty good in terms of the number of people who want to be involved and the number of airlines and the number of freight forwarders who want to be involved. But watch this space. There'll be an announcement later today, and then that'll all be on our website, and we'll link it through to you as well, Nick.
Okay, terrific. And I'd probably add too, was it Patricia, that probably, so obviously you'll get more detail later today, but I'd imagine too that keep in touch with whoever does your freight logistics for your freight forwarder. I'm pretty sure they're all the freight forwarders out there and all the logistics consultants are going to be all across this very quickly.
Yeah, they are. If the numbers that I've heard are any indication, absolutely they are.
Yep. So keep an eye on that. Talking about some of the data, I've got a question here from Tom. Some crystal balling. How do you, God bless.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, we love a bit of crystal balling. Come on, economists.
Yeah.
That's right. How do you see the next 3 months? We're looking forward to Q2. What are you expecting in terms of the recovery here? Got any sense of whether the temporary suspensions on entry by foreign nationals will be lifted? That's a part of it as well. I think the short answer to that is don't know, but any crystal balling that you want to do?
So I might just deal with the sort of foreign nationals first. I mean, we have no, There's been no suggestion that those measures will be lifted anytime soon. The Chinese system is still very clearly worried about imported cases, and even though the vast majority of those have been Chinese nationals returning to China with the illness, there have been a small number of foreigners who've had it. So I think that's unlikely in the near term. On the crystal ball question, thanks a lot, Tom. Look, I think in terms of the shape of the recovery, it's been interesting that since, for example, in the third week of March, the economy was about 70%, and in the middle of April, second week of April, it's in the early 80s. So it's actually taken quite a long time to come back up, you know, another 10% of capacity, which means that towards the end of April and into May, the Chinese economy will still be below where it would normally be. I don't know what that means in terms of, I'm not going to give you a GDP number for the second quarter, it's a bit early for that, but it's a very gradual process. And as I said in my remarks, we're also now seeing a synchronised global downturn in demand for Chinese exports, which will have to be a factor for the second and third quarters of the year. So in terms of the shape of the recovery, there's the V-shaped recovery, there's the U-shaped recovery, and I heard one commentator earlier in the week talk about a bathtub-shaped recovery where it's actually, you know, the bottom of the U is quite long. I'd say we're probably between a U-shaped recovery and a bathtub-shaped recovery for China, but the third quarter will be critical.
Maybe one of those small old British-style, you know, yeah, bathtubs.
Yeah, lucky, that's
right. A B-day-shaped recovery.
recovery. I've got a question here from Michael too. So who's in the digital content space. What are the best channels to get service offerings in front of Australian businesses interested in developing their brand in China? That could be an Australian. And I'll preface this by saying I actually had an inquiry from somebody who does digital content in Australia actually yesterday, talking about this very issue, that a number of his clients were sort of looking more to China, given that there's more of a recovery going on here than what's expected elsewhere. So I'll put that context in there too.
So this is for a bricks and mortar business looking at digital, or is it a digital business looking to?
Well, they're a digital content creator to assist Australian businesses with their digital content who might be looking towards China. What do you think there's some good channels are for that?
So there's lots. Was it Michael?
Michael.
I actively encourage Michael to send me an email afterwards and we might have a conversation about it. But there's probably, you know, three or four different groups. There's those that are the large platforms, the e-commerce platforms that can help with the scale and the size of what you're trying to do. There are those that are good analysts of consumer behaviour here, and China Skinny is certainly one that ticks that box. But there are others who have delved deep into the Chinese consumer behaviour, because that's at the core of what you're trying to do when you're getting into digital content here. It's trying to understand what works and what markets well. We have a series of pretty good content creators here. So it's not an area where it's easy to be competitive if you're coming in from the outside, would be something that I'd say. So you're better off partnering, I'd suggest, with some of those companies here. Probably best to have a more detailed conversation, and I'll put Michael in touch with Dane Richmond, who sort of leads our e-commerce work, I think.
Well, good stuff. Yeah, and I say I had an inquiry yesterday from an Australian agency about this very issue. So, and I'm sure, Michael, too, that I'll put you in contact with Dan. And then I'd also think about touching base with not only us, but ACBC back in Australia.
Yeah,
they would also be a good channel as well. By the way, we do all of what we're doing at the moment with ACBC, so thank you to James and the whole ACBC team. That's terrific. We're running up on time, so what we might finish with is we might go for some observations, conclusions. Yeah, there's been a lot of commentary about sort of regionalism, de-globalisation. I mean, clearly from a business chamber perspective, I think there's not a positive. As a small open economy, and our companies by nature are very nimble and agile and need significant amounts of global trade. So I don't think it's certainly in Australia's interest or our company's interest to go down this path, but do you think that's a real concern?
Look, I think it's a real risk. You know, every night before bedtime, I read a few chapters of The Economist magazine.
Yes.
I think in this week's episode, they were talking about decoupling or a partial reversal of globalisation as being one of the three key pre-existing trends that the virus will probably exacerbate. I think from recall, the other two were the kind of shakeout in the business sector, increase in the number of large companies and their connection to government, and the sort of drive towards e-commerce and online activity. But Australia doesn't want to see decoupling or anti-globalisation. I'd describe us as a medium-sized, highly exposed international economy. We've relied on trade for a couple of hundred years to give us many of the things that we can't make ourselves and on the rest of the world to take the exports that we can't consume. Australia exports about 70% of its agriculture, for example, and we've relied on foreign capital to develop many of those opportunities we can't do ourselves. So we're not in favour of that sort of trend. Australia is doing what it can in forums like the G20, for example, to make the case for keeping markets open, keeping investment flowing. I mean, we've changed a few of our investment settings as a temporary measure to get us through the period of the crisis, but over the longer term, Australia will continue to argue for an open international economy.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's hope that turns out to be the case. I think it's all in our interest for that to happen. Any final thoughts, comments?
No, I think all of the questions gave me an opportunity to say what my final thoughts were. If we can get B-day shaped curve trending, that would be an excellent outcome for me.
What's a It's a thought to finish on. Well, thank you everyone for dropping in. It's a Friday, so look, go and have yourself a terrific weekend if you're tuning in back in Australia. I see that infection rates are going down. Let's hope that trend continues. If you're over here on the mainland or in Greater China, enjoy a terrific spring weekend as much as you can. Stay tuned for what we've got coming up. We will be doing some webinars next week and the week after, a little bit more industry focused. I'll touch base again with the ambassador about him doing an update with us in the coming weeks as well. So that's something else that we'll have a look at as things continue to develop very, very quickly, and we'll try and keep on top of it. And again, if you've got any feedback, any ideas, any things that you'd like us to pursue in these sorts of forums, feel free to send them to me directly. And once again, have a great weekend. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Tiana. Thank you, Lachlan. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.